There's a few of you off a little bit. Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 31 says, "By faith the harlot Rahab did not perish with those who did not believe, when she had received the spies with peace." Rahab is an interesting character to me, not just because of her position before, considering even the Bible there in Hebrews 11 says that she was a harlot. It recognizes that fact from Joshua chapter 2. Some people, they want to purify the Bible in their minds. They want to make it a little more socially acceptable. And so they remove information about the people of God's Word. And there are individuals in the Bible that sometimes you'd rather not know. There are people in the Bible that sometimes you'd rather not think about the kinds of things that they do. And while Rahab ends up being a really amazing character in the Scriptures, ends up being, even in the lineage of Jesus, according to Matthew chapter 1, being, according to Ruth, the book of Ruth, is Boaz's mother, she has a hard beginning. And I think oftentimes she gets a hard sale on our part. In Joshua chapter 2, we read of a woman who finds spies in the land, who finds individuals from Israel who are coming over the Jordan and are spying out the land, are looking for their defenses, for their weaknesses, for the opportunities they might have to do damage, and are going to report back. And the king finds out about this. The leader of this area finds out about these spies and so seeks after this woman, Rahab. And though she is a person of this area, though she's dwelt in this land, she's got her own establishment, and it obviously runs off of the proceeds that the people bring in. And these Israelites probably have never, well, they've never been there before. They've been in Egypt this whole time, and they've been wandering through the wilderness for 40 years now. She has an allegiance to them. She shows her allegiance, we find here in the book of Joshua, chapter 2. But there in Hebrews 11, we're still staying in Joshua 2, don't turn your page yet. But there in Hebrews 11, "By faith the harlot Rahab did not perish with those who did not believe." The rest of Jericho, we find, were destroyed utterly. The city of Jericho itself, destroyed utterly. And it was created a heap, according to God, in Joshua chapter 6. And in Joshua chapter 6 and verse 2, we read, "And the Lord said to Joshua, See, I have given Jericho into your hand, its king and the mighty men of valor." This was a condemnation of the city of Jericho, that God said, "I am going to destroy it. It is going to be demolished." And then in Joshua chapter 6 and verse 24, we read of the relationship that Rahab had. Here in Joshua chapter 6 in verse 24 it says, "But they burned the city and all that was in it with fire. Only the silver and gold and the vessels of bronze and iron they put into the treasury of the house of the Lord. And Joshua spared Rahab the harlot, her father's household, and all that she had. So she dwells in Israel to this day, because she hid the messengers whom Joshua sent to spy out Jericho." I love that the Bible does not fudge on the information. That it does not try to make it politically correct. That it says what it is, and it lets those things stand. Now, the Bible does not condone what practices she had before she came across the people of Israel. It does not condone many of the things that she probably was involved in. And yet, it does condone and says explicitly her actions in regard to the spies. That she hid the spies. She received the spies in peace and then hid them, according to Joshua chapter 6. And because of that, her whole household was saved. We see there in Joshua chapter 2 in verse 8, destruction is coming, friends. Destruction is coming. Destruction of Jericho in particular here in Joshua chapter 2. Rahab knew it. Now we know it because we have 20/20 hindsight. Because we can look in the Scriptures and we can see that God in fact did give the Israelites, as the Hebrews writer talks about, as they circled the city 7 days, He gave them victory over the city of Jericho. That the walls came down, and the people marched in and completely obliterated the forces that were there in Jericho. Except for Rahab. But even Rahab, it seems, understood what was going on. Joshua chapter 2 and verse 8, it says, "Now before they lay down, she came up to them on the roof and said to the men, 'I know that the Lord has given you the land, that the Lord has given, that the terror of you has fallen on us, and that all the inhabitants of the land are faint-hearted because of you. For we have heard now how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea for you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were on the other side of the Jordan, Sihon and Og, whom you utterly destroyed. And as soon as we heard these things, our hearts melted, neither did there remain any more courage in anyone because of you. For the Lord your God, He is God in heaven above and on earth beneath.'" They had heard the stories, and Rahab knew what was going on. She saw the signs of what was transpiring, that the Lord had crossed these Israelites through the Red Sea on dry ground, as the Bible describes. And that news, as well as the victories of this small people against these mighty armies and these mighty kings, has spread. And so she knows that Jericho is going to be destroyed. And in Joshua 6:2, as we read just a second ago, it is said explicitly, finally, to Joshua, and he is finally told of the news that Rahab's known for four chapters now. What we need to recognize in the 21st century, 2 Peter chapter 3, is that this world will be destroyed in a similar manner. 2 Peter chapter 3 and verse 7, the Bible there reads, "But the heavens and the earth, which are now preserved by the same word, are reserved for fire until the day of judgment and perdition of ungodly men. But, beloved, do not forget this one thing, that with the Lord one day is as 1,000 years, as 1,000 years as one day. The Lord is not slack concerning His promise, as some count slackness, but is long-suffering toward us, not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance." In verse 10, "But the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in which the heavens will pass away with a great noise, and the elements will melt with fervent heat. Both the earth and the works that are in it will be burned up." He says the world is going to be destroyed, and is in fact in the process of being destroyed if you look at the world today. Not just in the sense that it's going to be destroyed in the end when the second coming comes and the saints are taken up, but in a metaphoric way. The destruction of the spirituality of the world, of the individuals here, that the world is becoming more and more ungodly. And though it makes ebb, there is some ebb and flow that goes on, though sometimes we make recourse and we change our ways to a slight degree, we're much like, especially here in this nation, we're much like what Jonah discovered, and then finally Amos, that this place is going down. This place is going to be destroyed. And if we do not change our ways, it is going to continue to be destroyed. I understand the draw of monasteries. I can see it. The peaceful place of spiritual solitude where you can praise and worship God and you can live the Scripture without the world's distractions and interference. I can understand that. I can see the draw that it has. And people talk about, well, I don't know if I could give up these things about this world. And while I don't know whether I could or not, but I can definitely see. Get away from the nonsense and the mess this world has become. The problems that you face on a daily basis. The decisions that you have to make flipping through the channels, for instance. That you have to cognitively decide not to watch some programs. That you have to decide ahead of time that you're not going to drive certain routes for the things that you're going to see. That you're not going to deal with some people in the ways that you want to deal with them. You're not going to talk to them because they have terrible language and it rubs off on people. But leaving this world in that way, drawing into a monastery, being a recluse in that way, is not the way God designed it. 1 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 9. He says, "I wrote to you in my epistle not to keep company with sexually immoral people. Yet I certainly did not mean with the sexually immoral people of this world, or with the covetous or extortioners or idolaters, since then you would need to go out of the world." There it is, the monastery. He says, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm not saying that you need to avoid at all costs everyone who is sexually immoral, an idolater, who speaks presumptuously, or whatever those things these people, all the sins that they might be involved in. He says, "But now I have written to you not to keep company with anyone named a brother who is sexually immoral or covetous or an idolater or a reviler or a drunkard or an extortioner, nor even to eat with such a person. And you might say, well, what in the world? Why would you say that? Not to keep company with them who claim to be a brother, because they're not a brother at all. They're an idolater, they're a fornicator, they're those things, but they're claiming to be a brother. He says there's a difference. It's just not possible to leave this world in that way. Because Matthew chapter 5, verses 14 through 16 says that we are the light of this world. That we exist in that capacity, and as the Lord wants us to be a city set on a hill. That when individuals would see our good works, they would glorify God the Father. It's difficult for them to see our good works and the light that we can share with others when we live in a monastery. When we're not around people. When we're out living in this world. And so Paul, as well as Jesus himself, he says, that's not what I'm after. That's not what I'm looking for. I'm looking for you to be spiritually well to where you can go out and you can share the gospel of Jesus Christ with people who are sinners and tax collectors and prostitutes. And that you can help people understand their relationship with God, just as Jesus did. The scribes and the Pharisees, they got on Jesus all the time for eating with sinners and tax collectors. They go to his disciples all the time saying, what in the world is he doing? He's eating with these unrighteous people, not recognizing their own unrighteousness and the things that they're not doing right. And they're quick to condemn these individuals. And Jesus in John 17. In John 17, in verse 14, Jesus prays that we would have the umbrella from God of grace and protection. In verse 14, he says, I have given them your word, and the world has hated them because they are not of the world, just as I am not of the world. I do not pray that you should take them out of the world, there it is again, but that you should keep them from the evil one. They are not of the world, just as I am not of the world. Sanctify them by your truth, your word is truth. As you sent me into the world, I also have sent them into the world. And for their sakes, I sanctify myself, that they also may be sanctified by the truth. The difference between us and them, if you want to make that designation, the difference between a brother and someone who's not a brother is sanctification by the word of God. Is that we have sanctified ourselves and that the Lord has sanctified us through his word. But he says, I don't pray that you take them out of the world. I don't want you to build a retreat for individuals, for Christians, and then you have them sit on an island, and then you push the island out into sea, where they can all live together in this prosperity, in this utopian society. He says that doesn't work. Because my goal is to save sinners, is to bring the lost to me. And they need to be involved in that. And so Jesus prays not that we would be removed from the world, but that you think of an umbrella. That God gives us an umbrella of grace and protection. An umbrella doesn't make it stop raining. You go out, you look out, and you see the sky, and it's starting to rain. You go grab your umbrella, and as soon as you get it, there's some magical potency in that umbrella that the rain just goes away. That's not what an umbrella's for. An umbrella doesn't make it stop raining. It keeps you from getting wet while it comes down around you. And that's what the grace of God does for us. That's what the protection that God provides is for. Not necessarily that it keeps evil people away from us, that it totally takes us out of the world, but that we've got this shell of protection that we can traverse this world and all the dangers and all the problems and all of the stuff that even Jesus dealt with. And we can do it in a spiritual way that we can be a light to this world. Because we have that umbrella. In Psalm 91. Psalm 91, we're going to read the first 10 verses here. He says, he who dwells in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty. I will say of the Lord, he is my refuge. Notice that word. He is my refuge and my fortress. My God, in him I will trust. Surely he shall deliver you from the snare of the fowler and from the perilous pestilence. He shall cover you with his feathers, and under his wings you shall take refuge. There's that word again. His truth shall be your shield and buckler. You shall not be afraid of the terror by night, nor of the arrow that flies by day, nor of the pestilence that walks in darkness, nor of the destruction that lays waste at noonday. Verse 7. 1,000 may fall at your side, and 10,000 at your right hand, but it shall not come near you. Only your eyes shall you look, or only with your eyes shall you look, and see the reward of the wicked. Because you have made the Lord, who is my refuge, even the Most High, your dwelling place. No evil shall befall you, nor shall any plague come near your dwelling. A hedge of protection that exists. He says God is our refuge. He is our secure shelter through the storms of this life. He is that umbrella that we take out into the rain. And though rain doesn't really pose that much of a threat to us, if you make the analogy of sin and temptation, as well as all of the perils of this life, all the things that can go wrong, friends, the Lord delivers you through those things. He takes care of us in times of need. That we might like to draw into monasteries, into reclusion, we don't have to, friends, because the Lord is our refuge. We don't need a place where we can get away from everything, because we have the Lord, and in Him we hide ourselves. We hide our very souls in Him. And we put ourselves in His trust. And the Lord brings us through those things. Rahab's house became her family's refuge while destruction falls all around it. That city was full of Israelites. And they were doing what the Israelites were supposed to do, destroying the city. And it was in Rahab's house that sanctuary was found. Notice Joshua chapter 2, starting there in verse 12. He says, "Now therefore I beg you," this being Rahab, "swear to me by the Lord, since I have shown you kindness, that you also will show kindness to my father's house and give me a true token, and spare my father, my mother, my brothers, my sisters, and all that they have, and deliver our lives from death." So the man answered her, "Our lives for yours. You saved our lives, we're going to secure your life. Our lives for yours," he says. "If none of you tell this business of ours, and it shall be when the Lord has given us the land, that we will deal kindly and truly with you." Then she let them down by the rope through the window, for her house was on the city wall, she dwelt on a wall. And she said to them, "Get to the mountains, lest the pursuers meet you. Hide there 3 days until the pursuers have returned. Afterwards you may go your way." Now, before we read 17, I want you to see the grace of God oftentimes comes with stipulations. There are things that we are required to do in order to receive it. Verse 17, "So the men said to her, 'We will be blameless of this oath of yours, which you have made us swear, unless when we come into the land, you bind this line of scarlet cord in the window through which you let us down, and unless bring your father, your mother, your brothers, and all your household to your own home. So it shall be that whoever goes outside the doors of your house into the street, his blood shall be on his own head. He will be guiltless, and we will be guiltless. And whoever is with you in the house, his blood shall be on our head if a hand is laid on him. And if you tell this business of ours, then we will be free from your oath which you made us swear.' Then she said, 'According to your words, so be it.' And she sent them away, and they departed." And notice what she does. The first thing that she does when they leave. "And she bound the scarlet cord in the window." He said, "Bind it before we come." So she lets them down. He says nothing. They're going to spend, he says, some time in the mountains. She still immediately goes and binds that scarlet cord, that token that they told her to put up. He says, if Rahab's house became her family's refuge while everything around was going to mess, if she put the scarlet cord in the window, if all of her family was in the house, they couldn't guarantee anyone out of the house, but that house would be safe, it would be secure, it would be a haven, a refuge to that family, and as long as she did not tell anyone about that plan. Friends, the church is our refuge. Matthew chapter 16 and verse 18. Jesus says, "On this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it." We looked at this morning, the weapons that the devil carried before Jesus came, they were extensive, and they were dangerous. And now the Lord has removed those weapons from them if we are faithful to Him. If we are faithful to Him. 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 17, he says, "For the time has come for judgment to begin at the house of God. And if it begins with us first, what will be the end of those who do not obey the gospel of God? Now, if the righteous one is scarcely saved, where will the ungodly and the sinner appear?" You ever been in a situation where you just barely made it through? You're talking about the skin of your teeth, whatever that means. the skin of your teeth. There have been so many times where, frankly, I should have died. I really should have. I mean, stabbed in the back with a pencil, barely missed my spinal column. Head injuries, more than I can count, which explains probably some things for you folk. Just all kinds of reasons why I should frankly just be dead right now. And yet, I was scarcely saved. And he says, if the righteous are scarcely saved, which we are. We're not saved on our own accord, on our own abilities. We can't compound good works to where we have so many good works that it overshadows the bad that we've done. We never come to a position in that life. We are always at the grace of God. And when we say that, by the grace of God, these things happen. And we know exactly what that means. Just barely. That's the only thing that took us over the line. Now, the grace of God is extensive. It's great. It's amazing. But in relation to our life, it's by that much. And he says, if the righteous one is scarcely saved, where will the ungodly and a sinner appear? Therefore, let those who suffer according to the will of God commit their soul to him in doing good. That's what Rahab did. She was suffering, or would suffer, saw the potential for the suffering that her family would endure, saw the relationship she could have with God, knowing that he, as by her own words, he was the true God. He was the only one that really was there. And so the things that transpired that brought the Israelites over the Red Sea and through the Egyptians, frankly. And so she committed her soul and her family's soul to them in doing good. He says, as a faithful creator. But friends, the judgment begins with us. It begins with the house of God. But that's okay. Because if we are faithful to Christ and we trust in His promises, we have nothing to fear. We have no concern for death. We have no worry. If the things that we say might spark a bad feeling in someone and they might decide to end our lives. We don't fear, Matthew chapter 10, verse 28, those who kill the body but cannot kill the soul. We fear the one who can kill both body and soul in hell. That's the only thing we fear. That's the only thing that we're concerned about. Our relationship with God, because that's the only thing that matters. Because He is our refuge. He is our fortress. He is our mighty defender. And He can bring us through those things. In 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 and verse 2. I love Paul's discourse here. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 and verse 2, he says, "For you yourselves know perfectly that the day of the Lord so comes as a thief in the night." You talk about those individuals. You talk about those individuals there in Jericho. Those walls were circled for 7 days. It was no surprise what these Israelites were doing. The surprise came on the seventh day when the walls came down. The surprise came not to Rahab, though. Now, it might have, in a way, but it wasn't the kind of surprise that the other people of Jericho had. The other people of Jericho were like, "Hey, the people are coming in right now." Rahab was like, "That's what's going to happen. This is exactly what's going to transpire." He says, "For when they say peace and safety, then sudden destruction comes upon them as labor pains upon a pregnant woman, and they shall not escape," like those individuals in Jericho. Verse 4, I love this. "But you, brethren, are not in darkness, so that this day should overtake you as a thief." Rahab was not in darkness. She knew what was going to transpire. Maybe not the extent of it. She didn't know the beginning from the end, but she knew what was going to happen. And she knew if she trusted in these men, because of the God of Israel, because of the God in whom she trusted, He was faithful, she knew He'd bring her through. And so she did what God commanded. What these men commanded her to do. She put the cord in the window. She brought her whole family in. And she didn't tell anybody about it. And in that, her house became that refuge. And in such, the church becomes our refuge. We aren't worried about a thief. We're looking forward to a friend. And that's the difference, friends. That's the difference. We are not in darkness that this day should overtake us as a thief. Jesus, when He comes, we might be surprised that He's here, but it won't be in the same way that individuals who are not Christians find Him. They will see Him and go, "I really should have done something differently." And we will see Him and say, "I've been waiting for you. I've been hoping that today would be the day that you would return." Because we greet Him as a friend, not as an enemy. We greet Him as a servant, not as a disobedient slave. We greet him as an obedient child of God. Noah and his family was prepared for the flood, but it came as a shock to everyone else. And though it may very well have taken a number of days of raining for them to figure out what was going on, that day that realization dawned must have been a sad day. But Noah and his family, they knew what was going on. They were not in darkness that that day and those 150 days would come as a surprise to them. 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 2, and verse 21. There is also now an antitype which saves us, baptism, not the removal of the filth of the flesh, but the answer of a good conscience toward God. Peter is making a reference back to the people who were saved through water in the ark. That those individuals who knew what was happening, and they moved with godly purpose, according to Hebrews 11. That Noah, being divinely warned of the things that would transpire, he built that ark according to God's specifications, and when God told him to get on that ark, he got on the ark and the animals came. And when it was time, God shut the door. And after God shut the door, it was too late. When the men of Israel, when the nation of Israel circled the city of Jericho for 7 days, friends, it was too late. It was too late for them to change their minds. Rahab had changed her mind when it was appropriate to change her mind. She served the Lord when it was appropriate to save the Lord. And there are many individuals who will try very deeply to convince the Lord that they had served Him, and He will know the truth. He will know the truth of their actions, of their choices, of their hearts. But friends, He will also know ours. He will know that we come as obedient servants, as friends and loved ones. And He will not come as a thief in the night that we're not expecting. He will come as a friend we've not seen in a while. Friends, if you need to prepare for the coming of the Son of God, whether that comes in the end of your life or the second coming of Christ, we must be prepared for that time. And it takes time to prepare. It takes opportunities to prepare. And it takes commitment to prepare. We don't know what Noah went through building that ark, of the ridicule, the things that transpired in the time it took him to craft that ark by hand. And yet we see the wisdom of him being prepared, that his family was saved. 8 righteous souls that day were saved through the flood. And through the watery grave of baptism, through your obedience to Christ's will, you can be saved in that day, whenever it comes. That you can be prepared when the moment arrives and Christ returns, or the end of your life arrives. And friends, I pray whatever you need to make that possible, to get yourself prepared, to be ready in that time of need, that you wouldn't wait until it's time. Because at that moment, it'll be too late. It'll be too late to change. I pray whatever you need, that you would come as we stand and as we sing.